Are you going to put up the deck for the first presentation?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I wasn't sure if we were up first still or if TR Bot was going first, but I will welcome the opportunity and bring up the
Well, you
presentation
know
now.
what? That's a great question. We have guests here tonight, so I'm quite happy to have our guests do their presentation first. You're welcome to obviously stay on for the full meeting, but we don't want to keep you longer. We do appreciate your time. So why don't we go with the TR Bot presentation first? That's a great suggestion. Thanks, Brittany.
It's great. Thanks very much. We appreciate that. So I think Craig's going to share our slides. Here we go. So thanks very much for having us. I'm Roselle Martino. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy here at the Toronto Region Board of Trade, and I'm the executive lead for the pilot zone initiatives that you're going to be hearing about very shortly. Craig is one of the policy directors on my team, and has been spearheading Pearson and Scarborough pilots. And again, I'll give you a bit more context about that. But what we're just before we get into Pearson, because this is really about the Pearson Employment Area Pilot Zone, the Toronto Region Board of Trade actually have worked on three different pilots. And if you just go to the next slide, I'll give you a bit of context for it before we dive deeper into this particular pilot zone area. So the board launched on a very ambitious endeavor, which was to solve for the reopening and recovery of business districts, really looking across the pandemic, across diverse regions, or diverse business and industry across the Toronto region that faced many challenges. And so we convened three different pilot zones, and again, I'll give you context for that in just a minute in the next couple of slides, to really solve for those that weren't open, which is the financial district, as you see there, and those that were open, which was in the Pearson pilot zone, had a lot of essential workers. So how do we solve for reopening and putting in the right conditions and creating the right mitigations based on global best practices to support the safe reopening? And then, of course, for those that were already open, how do you support a continued safe environment, sustained recovery, and not keep shutting down because those essential workers were so critical? And in fact, it was the essential workers in the Pearson pilot zone that enabled those workers in the financial district to actually work from home. They wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for the kind of work and supports that the essential workers in Pearson were doing. So we embarked on this quest, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the different zones in just a minute. But if we can go to the next slide, please, Craig. So just to contextualize all of this for you, our Economic Blueprint Institute, which is the data and research arm in the Board of Trade, identified five districts. It's part of Shaping Their Future playbook, which is available on our board's website. But these five districts are what you see there: Metropolitan Centre, Goods Production and Distribution, Services and Mixed Use, Regional Centres, and Knowledge Creation. And these business districts are pretty typical of what you'd see across North America and internationally as well. So from those five business districts, we identified three pilot zone areas in which we could solve for, as I mentioned, the reopening or sustained and safe from continued recovery. So the financial district pilot zone, obviously, as you see there, is the financial district, Pearson, and this is again, most urban centers would have a financial district. Most urban centers have goods distribution, and that's what the Pearson Employment Area Pilot Zone represents. And Scarborough Center is a typical example of your local economy, right? They're a mix of both. They're a mix of retail, a little bit of a little bit of government offices, some industry, different kinds of industry there, but that's your typical local economy, or your regional center, if you want to use business district language. So those were our three pilot zone areas. If we can go to the next slide, please, Craig. So in order to come up with what would be the best playbook to support, you know, continued recovery, we had established one for the financial district, which really was a lot of mitigations, and I'll explain that to you in just a minute. But you know, how could we take those mitigations, those leading practices, and apply that to the issues and challenges that the Pearson area were facing, because they were different, right? It's a business district, a business different industry, and different issues and challenges. So this is who comprised our steering committee. It was co-chaired by Jan De Silva, our CEO, Mayor Crombie, Todd Letts, and David Rochek from the Brampton Board of Trade and Mississauga Board of Trade. And we're really, really, really fortunate to have them. And I think there's colleagues from MBOT on here today. I'm pretty sure I saw somebody from MBOT on there. I just want to acknowledge their contribution and their involvement. It was really much appreciated. And these are all the participating organizations as well. So we had a good cross-section of different industry and different sectors as part of the steering committee. Next slide, please, Craig. So this is what really framed our financial district, what I call playbook. And then what we actually did was apply that and tailored it, made it more bespoke for Scarborough and for Pearson. But the main sort of components of it are safe district. So for Pearson, this included a coordinated workplace policies and communication, exposure, tracking, testing, and vaccination. And again, just for context, our playbook was really, it wasn't a must do, you have to do. It was based on global practices and what the organizations that you just saw in the steering committee, what were they doing? Because many of them were responding in isolation, trying to figure out things on their own in the absence of very, you know, poor communication, if I can say that respectfully, and differing and conflicting pieces of information, and different public health units were offering different pieces of information. So it was quite hard for businesses to really figure out what do we do. So we endeavored to try and obviously convene people together, and then also, you know, try and put the information and the, you know, the latest leading practices in some kind of cogent playbook that people could have a good reference guide and use as a tool to support their either, you know, recovery in their workplace or, you know, continued essential working in that environment. So safe district, I've spoken to that, safe buildings. This was really, again, looking at ventilation, airflow, air quality, monitoring technology, where we were, where they were issues, how could we provide, you know, what was happening globally and other best practices, just to, again, inform the work. Safe travel, this was much more of an issue in the financial district, I will acknowledge that, but it did come up both at Pearson and Scarborough, and obviously it was regarding public transit, carpooling, and active transportation. So what workers were hearing, and Pearson is great, fine, you're doing lots of stuff in my workplace to make me safe, that's great, but, you know, I still have to travel on a bus, I have to travel on, you know, a streetcar, a subway, et cetera, to get to work. And how are those going to be made safe for me? So it was that end-to-end journey that employees, again, essential, and those in the financial district and in Scarborough were raising in terms of end-to-end journey. So it wasn't just about their work space, their office place. It was about all these things. And then, of course, getting into to workplaces. And this was looking at not just, again, like their office or their little cubicle. It was about, you know, common areas, congestion management, those kinds of things. So, you know, elevator queues, that kind of stuff. How are all those things being managed? So, you know, worker spacing, cohort signage, et cetera, that was a real key issue. And so what we did was we convened a number of different tables. We had multiple showcases where we featured different technologies. You know, we had a number of information session and events. So with, you know, we had Dr. Isaac Bogosh, we had Dr. Lawrence Lowe, we had all the key players, you know, where we could to support the development of our playbooks and support businesses as they ventured through this quite challenging time. So steering committees and working tables, as you see there, public health and technical advisory groups, subject matter experts, and of course our implementation partners. So that's really what composed all the different mitigations in our pilot zones. Next slide. I think this is you, Craig. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Happy to have
you.
Thank you very much, Roselle. And thanks for having us, everyone. I'm hearing a bit of feedback. Is that gone? Great. So, I wanted to highlight a few of the lessons that specifically came from our Pearson Employment Area partners. Of the three pilot zones that we worked with, they were the ones that had the most experience working with the conditions of COVID, the essential businesses who kept everything running and learned a lot of lessons over the course of the year about what it's actually like to implement. And so we thought there were some really valuable learnings from that that we wanted to share with you and also highlight in our playbook because we think it can be useful to a lot of other businesses, particularly those who are just starting to think about going back. So the first one is that it really is a full-time job. It's not something that can be done off the side of a desk, and it really requires a lot of devotion and energy from the leadership of an organization, from managers, and, you know, constant reminders for workers at all levels to really be taking things seriously and ensuring that it's a part of their daily work to keep themselves and their colleagues safe. The second one is the need to be responsive. You know, the rules have changed more times than I can count over the last 15 months. And there are new issues that frequently emerge. One of my favorites that we heard from an organization was that they had put all these safety measures in place and eventually realized that when folks were going outside to smoke over the winter in bad weather, they would huddle together under the smoking shelters that were built, staying much closer than 2 meters apart. So sort of even with the best laid plans, there are often things that don't strike you at first glance. So the need to be responsive, be constantly vigilant, and looking for where some of those safety protections might be falling down and intervening to try and ensure everyone stays safe the whole day through. The third one is the need to be open, that employees really valued and benefited from employers who were transparent about the measures and why they were taking it, who maintained regular communication, who were able to give those regular updates about how things changed and how they would need to respond to it. And the fourth major lesson we wanted to highlight is the looking beyond the workplace. And this can place employers in a more uncomfortable position with the need to be a little more mindful and responsive and involved in their employees' life outside of work. So, you know, considering their employees' living arrangements, thinking about travel. We know some employers on our organization who are part of the steering committee were advising against carpooling, for example, that the health risks outweighed the environmental impacts, or in being sure to remind workers that if they were carpooling to stay masked throughout. Access and trying to help workers access vaccines and testing, whether it's on the job site or in their home community. So there's a lot of factors that layer on top of this that that employers needed to start being mindful of. And underlying it all is the core lesson that leadership is vital, that it really is about leadership, not just at the top of organization, but really throughout the organization at every level, ensuring that there's compliance, ensuring that the right policies are in place, and ensuring that you know, you're responding to the needs and concerns of the workers whenever they emerge. And at the bottom, we just wanted to highlight some of the ongoing challenges that we're continuing to look at, that we know a lot of businesses are continuing to look at. That's how to make sure you're maintaining compliance with all the mitigation measures that are in place, all the safety measures, really thinking through both helping employees access vaccinations and encouraging that uptake, And also thinking through human resources policies. Will it be mandatory? Will there be incentives for them to get vaccinated? I'm not going to wade into those legal questions today, but it is a major issue that we know many companies are still grappling with right now. Implementing rapid testing programs. We know, I see on the agenda that Redbutt's going to speak about the FAST program that MBOT developed later, which is phenomenal. Where possible, rapid testing programs are a great way of building confidence both for employees and for customers and to help maintain the safety of the workforce. And thankfully, the barriers and challenges to implementing it have continued to come down, which is very helpful. And finally, the transitioning to a new normal, understanding what post could look like and how that will impact both the ongoing operations and whether any new opportunities emerge from that. So that's another thing that we know companies are very actively exploring right now. And with that, I'll just share the link and the covers of both the playbook as well as the business district report. The playbook is available on the board's website today. The playbook will be launching tomorrow, so stay tuned to get your hands on a copy of that. And I will end the slideshow, and I think Roselle and I are happy to take any questions you have or any discussion points.
So I just wanted to correct you, Craig. The business district report called From Crisis to Opportunity will be available tomorrow.
Playbook's available now. Sorry, I'm stuck.
Okay, no problem.
Great. Thank you so much. And it's great, as I said, to have you both with us today to share this. I'm going to open up the floor for any members of the committee that may have questions for you. If you can just either speak up or use the hand function, that would be appreciated.
I saw Badr raise his hand on camera.
I was trying to get the hand motion going.
Go ahead, Badr.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent presentation. Thank you for taking the time out and explaining all of that to us. Quick question. In your work, did you also segment the business community along the lines of size by employees, or more or less it was just a generic focus on large cap businesses?
We did include businesses of all sizes in the committee work. We wanted to ensure diversity. So, in addition to, Amazon and Best Buy, who are there, the GTAA, we did have some organizations that were, in the 50 to 100 employees, I think even a couple that were under 50. So the diversity of experiences helped inform the work. We know that, one of the challenges we heard from the smaller companies was, obviously, the challenge of dedicating headcount to manage it, and that it really does sort of, that's, I think, part of the leadership is at every level conversation, the need to recognize that, you can't always, it's not someone else's job, it's the job of everyone in the organization to make it happen.
And Craig, if I can just add to that, and Badr, that's a really great question, because what we also really, heard from the smaller organizations in particular is, so we know in general recovery is going to be different for different sectors and it's going to be years. And I think the smaller organizations were really trying to flag the impact of that longevity of recovery, right? Like a larger organization has the resources and the tools to be able to invest in expediting that recovery. Smaller organizations don't have the same. So that was a real, real issue for them that they highlighted. And also for them, if I could just also mention, is about, for example, Main Street businesses. This is not about Pearson, but Main Street businesses on Kennedy Road in Scarborough, as an example. If e-commerce, has really dominated, how do they ensure that people are going to come back to their Main Street business, on Kennedy Road? This is what the world is now shifting to. If they can order, from sitting in the luxury of their home, how are they going to ensure they're going to get back to that? So very, very real issues that the small and medium organizations were raising and just kind of, that the impact of sustainability is not just for large orgs. So.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, Anyone else have a question for the group? I mean, I know when we look at how we've been impacted by COVID, and, you know, there's some sectors that have been impacted quite severely, the hardest hit, as we've been called. It does mean that recovery for, you know, many businesses will be faster than others. So, you know, that I think refer to as a case, where some industries are still staying deep in, and seem to have recovered quite nicely and are moving ahead. So, does the playbooks identify the different sectors in terms of where they're at in their recovery already, now that we're sort of 15 months along?
So yeah, I would say the playbooks don't speak to that specifically, but that's the a lot of the insights that are in the business district report. So those are the ones that are launching tomorrow, and those really have taken a lot of data from a number of sources and layered it on top to look at different types of districts, whether it's the goods production and distribution in the Pearson area or the regional centers, the knowledge creation districts, to really map how has mobility been impacted by the pandemic, how has commerce and retail transactions been impacted, and they're able to segment both on-site transactions as well as, you know, card-not-present transactions, which is typically e-commerce, to show sort of some of those differences and changes over time to give a sense of where it is. So that report is less sector-specific and more geography-specific, but it is, you know, there is sort of a sector aspect to it, if you will.
Yeah. And what with respect to your playbook question, what we've also done is the leading practices, which really are the mitigations, that is digitized, right, on our website. And they're going to be updated based on emerging technologies, and new public health requirements and the current evolving landscape, right? So, you know, what certain mitigations we might have needed, your, whether it be a company in Pearson, whether it be a company in Financial District, whether it be of whatever size, the mitigations that you might have needed in March are not going to be the same that you might need, you know, starting Friday, as an example. And so people can filter and base it on what's specific to their sector, filter the mitigations digitally and pick from that. So we've tried to make that really a usable, practical tool versus just having it all in a PDF document that, you know, can be outdated quite quickly.
That's great. Well, thank you again for the opportunity to present.
Thank you very much for coming again. I think you've created some really interesting tools well, Ed, you are welcome to stay, but I understand completely if you'd prefer to drop off. We do thanks for your time, and we'll make sure that members of our committee get copies of the presentation we shared today and your contact information if they have any further questions.
Great. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your time. So, okay.
Thank you.
All right, so our next item is our Ready For You. It's sort of the insight, Toronto Peer Health Airport and Recovery. So Brittany, I guess now is the time to put up our deck. And Michael, you're gonna kick things off?
I am. I don't know, I guess once it's up there on the screen, if everyone can see it, we'll just launch right into it. As Lori mentioned, much of the deck will address our Healthy Airport program, which I'm sure members of the committee are familiar with at this point, and how we're thinking about recovery and planning ahead in terms of the air sector's recovery. If we can move to the next slide, please. So you'll see impacts on May 12th of this year. The GTA published its first quarter results, and while we were hopeful, I think we were all hopeful to be on the rebound by now from COVID, the results tell a much different story, particularly when they're compared with Q1 results from 2020. And of course, you know, Q1 2020, which contains January and February from last year, and was pre-pandemic, you know, that has to be noted. And I'm sure many of us, sometimes it's difficult to remember a time that was pre-pandemic. But what stands out to me here when you compare Q1 of this year and Q1 of last year is the decrease in passenger numbers and the associated revenue loss. So you see in Q1 2021, we saw 1.1 million passengers move through the airport, and that's a reduction of 88% year over year from Q1 2020, which saw 9.6 million passengers. And of course, you know, with passenger numbers sharply declining and our revenue so closely tied to passengers, in Q1 2021, the airport reported a $127 million net income loss, which is a reduction of over 2,000% year over year from Q1 2020. So pretty staggering numbers. If we can move to the next slide, please. We continue to engage regularly, I would say regularly and often, with every level of government. We're talking to government, particularly the federal government, about a science-based phased approach to reopening international travel. And we're seeing some positive, what I would call positive incremental progress there in the form of an expert health panel report that Lori will talk about later in the presentation. In our conversations with government, we continue to stress the need to invest in critical airport infrastructure and low-touch technologies and provide the necessary support to do that. So a full waiver of airport rent for 2021 and 2022 would go a long way. And we're pleased to see all levels of government come together to support better regional transit connections, particularly the Eglinton Crosstown West extension. So many of you may have seen that announcement recently, and really pleased to see the province investing in tourism in their latest budget, reflecting that travel and tourism will be key to the province's economic recovery. So if we can move to the next slide, please. I think there's no question that vaccinations will be key to economic recovery. Very pleased to see the province designate frontline transportation workers, including airport and airline employees, as eligible for priority first doses. They became eligible on May 11th. And the GTA is really proud to have facilitated a Peel Region mass vaccination clinic at the GTA-owned International Center. We've also worked closely with the province to ensure temporary foreign workers are tested and vaccinated as they arrive at Toronto Pearson. And we sponsored the Region of Peel's vaccination clinic at the CAA Center in Brampton. It was a hockey hub concept held in an NHL-sized arena and will vaccinate up to 10,000 Peel residents a day. So hopefully you have a big impact there. And with that, I'll leave it there. I'll hand it over to Brittany to talk about some of our modernization and testing efforts at the airport.
Thanks, Michael, and hello, everyone. So on this slide, we're really just the intent is really to update you on some of the modernization pieces that we're anticipating will continue forward as the airport recovers in this post-pandemic world. We are focusing on technology innovations as part of the operational process for the passenger journey. And we are looking to the government through the federal airport critical infrastructure program to help cover the cost of implementation. And really, there are three different aspects of the passenger journey that are currently being reviewed and updated. And so the first one is improving touchless processes for check-in and bag drop. And the new technology advancement in this capacity is allowing the passenger to use their phone to control the kiosks and bag tag printers to reduce the touch on a multi-person piece, and they can just use their personal phone there, which is really great. The second is modernizing the government agency processes. So we are working with USCBP on facial technology. We're working with CBSA to install e-gates for the customs area and in the Nexus area. And then additionally, CBSA is working on some pre-submission backend technology called RightTouch Air, and that'll help streamline the processing time at the kiosks and e-gates, because everything will be hopefully in the future, in the near future, able to be pre-submitted. And then in addition, you'll see in the bottom two pictures on this slide, we have a trial version of a supervised self-scanner for travel document checks at the boarding gate now. So passengers are able to check use the technology to check their travel documents without having to pass back and forth with employees and protecting from a health perspective at that point. On the next slide, we just wanted to keep you updated on the testing programs and studies that are in place at Pearson today. In previous meetings, we've gone over all of these studies in detail. And so for this slide, we're really just focusing on key updates for the programs that are happening here on the ground inside the airport. The mandatory arrivals testing as part of the border entry requirements continue. We continue to see passengers traveling for essential reasons landing at Pearson. Currently, on average, our testing provider, Switch Health, is processing about 1,000 tests per day across both terminals. And while passengers are here on site, they get their take-home kit for the day 8 test before they head to the mandatory hotel quarantine and wait for their arrivals test result. We recently completed our workplace antigen testing study, and this was an asymptomatic antigen testing study for employees only. So all airport employees were eligible, and we had over 675 people participating from over 60 different companies. Altogether, over the course of the 12 weeks, they completed 5,100 tests. The next steps for this study are the epidemiologists from University of Toronto that we have partnered with are taking that data, and they're going to undertake some research and prepare a report that has some medical perspective on the benefits of asymptomatic screening for the for large dynamic workplaces, and we expect to see that be released in mid-summer 2021. So in a couple of months' time. For the departing passenger antigen testing study, so this is a service as part of the study that's being offered to departing passengers going to destinations where antigen tests are accepted as part of their destination entry requirements. It's been available in Terminal 1 since mid-March, and we recently opened Terminal 3 at the beginning of May. Altogether, so far, we've tested over 11,000 passengers through using the antigen test service. And anyone who has, received a positive result on their antigen test has the ability to complete a confirmatory PCR test on site. Speaking of PCR testing, we are also undertaking a rapid PCR test study where they are comparing the PCR diagnostic result with a new Canadian-made antigen test that's in development. And so using these rapid PCR tests, the results are able to be returned to the passengers and employees within approximately 6 hours, most times less than that, but that is the turnaround time. So it's really great to be able to offer that as a service that's on site at the airport. Employees have been able to take advantage of this rapid PCR test since the end of April, and we've tested almost 500 employees to date. And for passengers, it's been available since the beginning of May in Terminal 1 and the beginning of June in Terminal 3. And altogether, we've done almost 5,000 tests for passengers as well. So that's just really how things are going operationally for the studies that are wrapping up. the testing studies are wrapping up within the next couple of months. And we do have a plan because we know that testing will continue to be part of our airport operations moving forward. So we're really in the middle of figuring out how to transition from these studies that are funded through the National Research Council to a more permanent service for the foreseeable future. Right now, we're in the middle of the RFP process phase. And once we've awarded the contract, we'll work to set up the more permanent facility. We are seeking federal support by submitting an application to the Federal Biosecurity Fund to cover some of the capital costs of implementing this more permanent facility at the airport. And once that's all set up, hopefully by the time the studies are complete, we'll undergo that transition phase to the new set of services. Again, we'll continue to offer antigen and PCR testing. We know that as vaccinations roll out around the world, it's possible that more countries will accept the rapid antigen test as opposed to PCR, but we want to make sure that we're offering both. It'll be available for employees and for all employees and passengers. And of course, we are interested in continuing to explore innovations that will improve the customer experience testing at an airport. And again, this will begin as the testing studies complete, so approximately in the middle of the summer this year.
Great, thanks very much, Brittany. I'll pick it up from here. So right now, I mean, we continue to see travel restricted to only essential travel. And for those essential travelers coming in from international destinations, as Brittany mentioned, they are required to pre-departure test, which is a PCR, the arrivals test, go to the quarantine hotel, wait for the results, and also do a day 8 test. There was an expert health panel that was put together to do a number of studies on behalf of the federal government. It's made up of researchers and scientists and health experts who are providing advice to the government of Canada on testing and screening. And they recently reported on border management and provided some advice to the government on moving forward in terms of measures to support the reopening of travel. Their report was made public on May the 27th. Key recommendations that they provided was the discontinuation of the quarantine facilities. They recommended the need to continue to be vigilant about testing to monitor for variants of concern. In terms of measures for travelers, they've broken apart their recommendations based on a traveler's vaccination status. And so you can see in the 5 boxes, there's recommendations related to a traveler who was vaccinated, someone who's had the virus and resolved within the number of days noted, and exempt travelers. They also recommended the requirement and need for Canada to have in place a system to verify and for a passenger to prove their vaccination status. So this is not government policy. This is a paper that's been provided to the government to inform future policy decisions. We've, as an airport and as part of our industry, along with our colleagues in the airline sector, have been engaging with government on the recommendations here and hope to see government start to make policy choices in line with the recommendations in the report. Obviously, it's keying off of numbers of Canadians vaccinated, first and second dose, as well as continuing to see the case counts in Canada continue to fall and go in the right direction. We have been asking the government to produce a plan. Well, so far, we've seen changes implemented, sort of one-offs and piecemeal. I think we shared at our last meeting, the UK put forward a plan that showed a framework of how travel would resume based on certain metrics being achieved and a stepped measure of approach to remove restrictions. we started to see provinces across our country doing the same thing. Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, BC, Ontario have all put out plans. But yeah, we're still, you know, hoping to see more than just sort of the next step, but actually a plan that would walk through the various steps that are coming towards full reopening. That can be obviously supported through health conditions. So on the next slide is a couple of papers were circulated to all of you a number of weeks ago. Pearson, as a major global airport, has engaged with a number of other global airports around the world, and we did so pre-pandemic. With the pandemic hitting us, we used it as an opportunity as a group, and you can see the logos for the airports that are part of this discussion, to support each other, to share information, to come together on what each other is learning. There's nothing like a health crisis to remove competitive issues, if you will. And one of the things that this group prepared was two discussion papers, one that set out some broad principles and approach for a roadmap to recovery. This has been written in such a way as it can be used by any government, you know, governments from the UK to, you know, Amsterdam, Australia, and Canada. We've also shared it with organizations like ICAO and IATA and Airports Council in the various regions around the world. And it sets out the framework we believe that you, just as I was talking about, we're looking for is a staged approach with key milestones identified so that we can see the plan more than just one step at a time. The other policy issue that this group took a deeper dive on is the issue of how do you globally have a system to verify vaccination status that can work to allow a Canadian to travel abroad, but other foreign nationals to travel as well and meet the requirements of other countries, to do so in a way that's not providing a lot of paper that slows down and gums up the flow, but actually works in behind in the back end of the systems, whether that's through your immigration system, you know, just like your process for traveling to another country. You need to know if you have the right visa and requirements to travel. You've got your Canadian passport. Do you need a visa? What other requirements does that country require? This would help to support the health requirements for travel. Paper does not say that to travel you must be vaccinated. It's a process to identify travelers who are vaccinated that helps to speed up the process because you've automated and digitized that process. Health data in Canada is at the provincial level. So as we're talking to our federal governments, we're also engaging at the provincial level for that pipeline of data to be provided in a way that, you know, gives me my health information that then I can use as I choose to use for travel or for other purposes. But for our interest, it's for travel purposes. It's something that we continue to hear progress is being made at the federal level. It's probably not a solution that will be fully in place and interoperable globally in the short term, but we hope that if the advice that industry is providing to governments is taken, that in the not too distant future, there will be a solution that helps to provide that proof of vaccination so a traveler can move seamlessly. The next slide really speaks to a paper that, you know, as you know, we're members of the Canadian Airports Council. It's our industry association. They engaged with Intervistas, a consulting firm that does a lot of work in the aviation space. And it was designed to speak to the competitiveness of aviation and airports recovering from the pandemic. One of the concerns that we have, you know, we're sitting 15 months later and still our traffic is still about 88% down. How other jurisdictions have begun to recover globally. We've looked at how other governments have provided support for their air sector, both in the airlines and airports, and really concerned about the competitiveness of the Canadian aviation sector moving forward. So this paper took a closer look at some of the risks if additional assistance isn't provided. Concern is, you know, when we look at what in terms of jobs and pre-pandemic and the role we play to support Ontario GDP, we want to make sure that as we recover, we're able to play that role again. But the competitive landscape has changed, and so it is on our minds going forward. So I think that probably provides a really nice segue because one of my colleagues, Julian Cotton, is here. Julian presented to the committee before, and he's going to share a couple of slides in terms of how a person's thinking about recovery from an air services perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Yeah, and a good setup it was. Thanks for listening to me for the next couple slides. I got two slides I think to share with the group. One about our competition and how we've kind of looked at it, and then second about some of the ideas and strategies behind our recovery. So my name is Julian Cron. I'm the Associate Director of Air Service Development or Global Market Development here at Toronto Pearson, and really looks at working with our carriers to grow our business. Whether it's more destinations, more airlines, more seats, or more frequencies, all in the spirit of growing Toronto Pearson and its reach on the planet. So when we talk about competition, what we talk about here is really three areas that I like to bucket them into. And these are all our catchment areas, but we have very different drive catchment areas. The first one on the left talks about our immediate competition. So Billy Bishop Airport just to the city center, and also we have Kitchener, Waterloo, as well as Hamilton not too far from us as well. So all have, leisure traffic. Toronto Island has a very good mix of business, has a very niche market. We do compete on many of the routes out of Hamilton and Kitchener, Waterloo, but all have a very unique draw to them as well. Even now recently with Flair Airlines announcing quite a large purchase of aircraft in the last year, and then deploying some of those assets in Kitchener. So having now Kitchener-Waterloo and a viable network to some destinations. The second group that we look at is the cross-border opportunities. And this is, you've heard a lot about this maybe in the past, about our leakage is a term that we use. So, people actually driving past Toronto Pearson, driving past Hamilton, to over the border, and then using some of the smaller airports out of the northern states and in the shared border cities. There is a draw to that, and primarily the draw to that is the cost of the fares are could be on the fare alone it could be 25% less. The taxes and surcharges compound that to somewhere around 30-40% price differential. So, if you're taking a family of five down to Florida for Disney, it starts to add up. But we do see this market as being very kind of unique, and there is some draw to that. And unfortunately, we just can't compare for many reasons on those levels. Whether it's a fare, like a low-cost carrier opportunity, or the rates and charges at this point in time. So we do see this growing, though, actually, in the short term a little bit, especially if the restrictions on travel, as you've heard today, continue much longer. And if the U.S. border starts to lighten up or open up, we could see that number actually increasing. So it is now become a bigger discussion point in the group about competition than pre-COVID at 50 million. The last group continues that competition if the U.S. border was to reduce its travel restrictions over any other international border. And what we have is then we have this, you know, 240-minute drive radius from Toronto, and it really focuses on the international competition of other airports. And, you know, inside that you get Detroit. You know, if you stretch it a little bit more, you get Cleveland. You know, you get some of the, you know, so you don't quite get Ottawa, but Ottawa it has less service than us, unfortunately. But you do get some of those U.S. destinations that might have access to other international routes that we don't have. So again, are people willing to drive, never mind to Buffalo, but are they willing to drive to Detroit from Toronto to get on an international flight? So these are things that we've been thinking about since COVID started, about how, not competition, but how the landscape has changed and what position does Toronto Pearson have. I can go on to the next slide, but if there's any questions or comments, we can stop maybe. And then the second part of this is really about how we, so pre-COVID, we had just punched through 50 million annual passengers. And has COVID, like many other industries or aspects of life, changed enough and changed the trajectory of recovery enough that we need to look at who and how business is going to come back to us? So we go over the course of every year, we evaluate our markets and our reach. But this year was quite different. So we've had to add some new variables, COVID variables for lack of terminology, but variables that were introduced now during COVID that maybe never came into play before. So when we think of the experience at an airport, you know, does that matter now than it did before? It definitely does, more so. You know, destinations that have an outdoor factor will come back stronger. That's in line with what we know to be true from recovery and what we've seen recover in other countries, the US, the UK, Australia and such. So we take all of those factors and then add them to our you know, the more traditional market evaluation metrics, whether they're socioeconomic, political, macro, micro, leading or lagging, and then apply those to the data sets that we know to be true for passenger volumes. And then it spits out this kind of list of destinations. And then it's up to the team now to kind of formulate some sort of, I don't want to say priority, but at least a phased approach is the terms we're using as to how recovery could be rebuilt. So what I've done for the group here today is broken it into three areas. So these are our sectors. So these are domestic destinations, transborder or to the U.S. destinations, and then international destination. And this is how the group sees the destinations coming back online as we get through COVID. And you'll see that there's some similarities between all three of them, actually. So I'll just quickly go through some of the big ones. The big ones are, you know, in domestic, the desire here is about connecting the provinces and capitals and large leisure destinations. That's what we know to be true and what we've seen from other groups, whether they're economic development groups or travel and tourism groups or the airlines themselves. Really feeling that this is how things are going to recover for us domestically. And then the leisure destinations really taps into a new market for many people. And it's this wilderness destination. So, you know, not going to some of the more leisure tourist spots, but more of the open country, open space, things like Yellowknife and Whitehorse. That never would have shown up on our destinations list pre-COVID. But given that they have now that outdoor experience, they score much better. In the U.S., you know, that one's a bit tougher as there's a large corporate Canada draw to the destinations in the U.S. from Toronto, given that our economic position for Canada here in Toronto that allows that to really facilitate some of the destinations we have out of Toronto to the U.S. However, the destinations you see there are very much aligned with partnerships and friends. So like anything, in times of need, you rely on your friends and your neighbors. And as such, the carriers are doing the same things with United and Air Canada, who have co-chair agreements and other agreements that allow them to access their networks from their home bases. So in this case, it would be Chicago for United and Toronto for Air Canada, but allowing that to happen. So that's where we get the New Yorks, Chicago's, Boston's, Detroit's, a lot of those big U.S. hubs that are facilitated by all three big carriers here in Toronto, American, Delta, and United. And then moving finally to the international side of things, again, some of the common themes I had mentioned is, you know, connecting big cities to big cities and networks to networks. These are very strong markets for us here in Toronto, London, Beijing, People's Republic of China with Shanghai, Beijing and Guangzhou, Hong Kong as well. But we also see strong European cores, or our trunk routes that we call. So things like Amsterdam, Frankfurt, London, Paris. And then again, the same theme that you're seeing with this wilderness campaign, or this really new interest in outdoor destinations, is Keflavik in Iceland. So we have a draw. We've always had a strong draw, believe it or not, to Iceland for outdoor leisure vacation. But given now this tourism, it really punches in a different class. So destination, you know, like Keflavik is now contending with London and some of the world's big city centers. So we've been having to constantly review this and move with times as you've, I'm sure, been all very in tune with the changing landscapes and as such in Toronto and Canada's position to, be a very conservative approach to reopening its borders domestically or internationally, say, compared to some of our other countries. So as a result, we feel like we need to just keep doing this and keep reevaluating this. So we are now moving forward with this first phase in engaging our 40 some odd airlines that service Toronto, and 80% of them continue to service Toronto at some degree through COVID through the year, which is a big win when you think about it, where a lot of cities lost connectivity, and not just in Canada, I'm talking about on the planet, and these airlines chose to continue at least some level of access because of the importance that we play to them economically and for moving people around the planet. So I hope that gives you some comfort as to understanding kind of where our headspace has been with competition, and then how we plan to roll that forward for the next few years as we get back to 50 million.
Thanks very much, Julian. And to the committee, I know that was a very large presentation, so I hope you were able to take it all in. Open it up the floor now to any questions that any members may have. So we covered a lot of ground. There was obviously sort of the financial piece, where we are as an organization, what we're doing on testing, a couple of advocacy pieces, where we are on restart, and then thinking ahead in terms of recovery, where those markets may be. So I saw a few folks come on screen. If that indicates you've got a question, put your hand up.
I don't know how much.
Hey, go ahead.
I don't know how much can be discussed at this point, but right now, do we have any input from the federal government about accepting these recommendations and trying to give the airport a bit of lead time in terms of implementing what's going to be necessary?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Can't hear.
We are, engaging with the government to review You can't hear me? We have been engaging with the government. I don't know. Can everyone hear me or not? Shane, can you hear me?
It cuts in and out.
So I'll give it another try. The conversations with the government are around the recommendations of the report. They have not signaled their hand, other than if you were reading the news yesterday or the day before, we've seen the Prime Minister starting to speak about a vaccinated and traveler and the ability of someone who's fully vaccinated to be able to get back to travel. And so that's a good signal and sign that we're picking up that is really motivated around, as you get vaccinated and more people get vaccinated, travel will be able to resume. Public health through Dr. Tam, they've indicated some metrics, some key metrics when, from a public health perspective, Canada will hit, you know, a level of vaccination status that would provide some level of herd immunity. And that would be 75% of Canadians having their first dose and about 20% having their second. And so there's another sort of metric we can think about in terms of when public health will be more comfortable starting to provide advice to the government around the ability for Canadians to travel again. The orders in council that are in place right now are sort of turning over on a monthly basis, so the restrictions on international travel. So the next point in time for them to come up would be the end of June. So those kind of provide some markers for us to think about when decisions may be made to make changes. We continue to hear that changes will be made in a phased, conservative way that maintains public health. And so June 21st is the next date when the Canada-US border restrictions would come up for review, as would the rules around international travel and simply keeping it essential. Maybe I'll see Ludwig. I don't know if you have anything further that you wanted to add to this discussion.
No, I think, Laurie, it's accurate to say that we as a government are considering all options. I'm not engaged in those discussions personally, but I do know that my colleagues up in Ottawa are considering all the recommendations that have come forward, whether they be from the CAC or, you know, yourselves as the leading airport in the country and others that are chiming in on these issues. We hear very clearly the phased approach is necessary. We also hear another thing, and that is everybody needs to get ready. I think if you look at the March return to the skies in the U.S., a lot of the airlines, ground staff, and were caught off guard with the kind of surge in demand. So I think this is an important factor to consider as we proceed through this recovery phase, that we provide enough early and important notice. So, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And just my apologies for my Wi-Fi being so horrible tonight. Any other questions from committee members? Right. We'll make sure that you have a copy of this presentation, and obviously we're always available to answer any questions offline. All right, Brad, I think you're up next. Brad's very kindly offered to provide us with an update on an initiative that the Mississauga Board of Trade took on for testing and providing a rapid test for businesses. So over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Laurie. I'm not sure if Ingrid is going to bring up the PowerPoint,
yeah,
if I'm bringing it up, or it's very short.
No, just give me one second.
It's super short. So, yeah, so there's the introduction. Brad Butt, Mississauga Board of Trade, slide two. So the Ontario Chamber of Commerce, in partnership with the Ministry of Economic Development, Job Creation and Trade, decided that we would launch through chambers of commerce all over Ontario, including Mississauga Board of Trade, that we would launch and run a program that would allow small businesses to participate in a rapid test program for their employees on site. The program started about a month and a bit ago. The Mississauga Board of Trade, our program has been up and running now for a week. But basically, this first screen will tell you exactly what it's designed. The program is designed to do, which is allow small businesses to participate. They would register. They have to complete, obviously, an agreement to participate in the program under the rules that have been established by the both by the Ministry of Economic Development, Job Creation and Trade, and the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, because there is a responsibility to report back on the number of tests administered and positive and negative results as well through a weekly form that needs to be done. But it's a simple program. You go online. I'll give you the website address at the end. You go online. You register your business. You book a time slot to visit us at our distribution site, which is at 55 City Center Drive in the right across from Square One Mall. And you come in, a representative of your company comes in. We put them through a little training video so that they know how to talk to their colleagues back at the business as to how to self-administer the swabbing and the full test to give us a rapid test result as to whether or not you might be COVID-19 positive. Now, this is an antigen test, not a PCR test. So we certainly would be encouraging those that perhaps test positive to go and get the secondary PCR test, which is more accurate than this is, but at least it gives you a measure of results as to what your situation might be. So then you complete the pre-screen COVID self-assessment form. You come and pick up your kits, as I said, and you have to report your weekly results. So this is the exact same program being rolled out by any participating chamber of commerce in the entire province of Ontario. So Mississauga is no different than Oakville, is different than, I think Brampton is coming in. They're not quite in yet, but I think they are going to be joining. Toronto is looking at a smaller program because they're obviously a massive city. But there's a number of chambers across the, I think there's 60 chambers now across the province of Ontario that are participating in this program. So this is for SMEs of 150 employees and less. So this is really a great program for businesses to sign up for. There is absolutely zero cost. Everything is provided for free. And when you run out of your kits because you've used them successfully in your business, you contact us and you can reorder if you want to continue to run that program within your business. So I guess next slide. So to assist businesses, and this is something that the Mississauga Board of Trade did on their own. This is not a program. This FAST program is not a program that's running throughout other jurisdictions. This is something we developed internally. Because when we talked to business people, they said, well, that's all great, but I'd love to have, you know, some guidance as to how I could actually run this program within my business. So we developed something called the FAST Antigen Screening Toolkit. So this is a free toolkit you can download from the MBOT website. The next slide will give you the two website addresses for this. You can download it. It's updated weekly if things change, if rules change, if the government's decided something else has happened and you as a business need to know what else to do. You'll get an automatic notification as to how things have changed, because there have been some changes since all of this started as to rules on the disposal of the kits and whether that's biohazardous waste or not. So other updates that we get as these programs evolve, we'll let businesses know. But this is a great toolkit you better go to implement the testing program that makes the most sense for you in your business, depending on the nature of the business. So that's another one that we've developed, again, free of charge, and we encourage businesses to take advantage of the FAST toolkit program as well. So last slide is just here are the here are the two links. I mean, you can just go to the Mississauga Board of Trade main website and you'll find all this, but those are the two specific links if you're interested in either of those programs. We're not, I guess the last thing I would say is it's not, you don't have to be necessarily a Mississauga-based company. We know that our colleagues in Toronto and Brampton aren't fully ramped up yet. So if you want to participate, you don't happen to be in Mississauga, and you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't have this program already, feel free to participate in ours. We're all in this together. There's no turf war in this stuff. If you're a company that really believes in doing this and being part of this program, we fully encourage you to be involved. But if you are in a catchment area where there's another chamber of commerce, and many of them in the Greater Toronto area are participating, I would encourage you to go to their programs, because they're, I know we have some friends on here from Vaughan and other parts of, I think, York Region that are on this call as well. So I know some of our chamber colleagues are running programs in those regions, so use theirs. But this is good information for people, good way for your business to participate in an important program. This is, again, one of those great tools to keep COVID out of the workplace. That's all we're trying to do here, is keep COVID out of workplaces so that they're not impacted by all this. So happy to open it up to questions, Lori, but just wanted to give a very quick report on what we're doing. And as you say, this is a program that is run by the Ontario Chamber of Commerce throughout the province, and individual chambers participating. So I'll leave it at that, but happy to take questions.
That's terrific, Brad, and congratulations on picking it up and running it out of the Mississauga Board of Trade. I'm sure there's lots of businesses that are appreciating the fact that it's there. Can you share any results in terms of the number of businesses so far that have made use of it?
I was there most of the day today, because Tuesday is my day to be at 55 City Center Drive and just be the supervisor for the day. The take up hasn't been as strong as I thought it would be. I would have thought it would have been a lot stronger. So I can't give you an exact number of how many companies specifically are participating. But when we did our numbers, our initial order was for 30,000 rapid test kits, which we have, and allocated and sent out already. I just had a call earlier this afternoon with the staff in our office. We're below 10,000 left in inventory. So we're very close to have sent out 20,000 of those kits. Now, obviously, they're not getting all used immediately. It'll take time in each company for those to get used. But I would say we're probably 40 or 50 companies that have signed up to participate in the program right now.
I think that's pretty good. So,
and it just depends on the size of the business. One representative of a company came in today, and I mean, he only took 100 test kits. The initial supply is for a 2-week period. The recommendation is that you ask your colleagues to do the self-administered test out of a 5-day week. It's recommended you do it twice a week. So you can, right, you can add up the numbers, number of employees times number of tests times, you know, 2 weeks or a month or whatever, and you'll get an idea how many kits are being used on a day-to-day basis, and then how many are and then when people need renewals, they call us and we refill where we can.
Caroline Pogrebe has a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah. Hi, Lori. Thanks. And hi, Brad.
Hi.
Yeah, I think the whole presentations today, always in the back of my mind, is that the consumer confidence piece. We're in such uncharted territory, and there's so many incredible moving parts that continue to move and never stop moving. So for full disclosure, my crystal ball is completely broken at this point and have no idea where this is headed. But it's just curious, Brad, I can first ask you, and then Lori, toss the same question over to you, in the sense sense of just the consumer confidence or just the human rights issues around, Brad, for you, for the testing? You know, are you seeing any issues in the workplace with people feeling that it's an infringement of their rights, or, you know, the whole idea of when can you test, why can you test, who should be testing, can you force people to test, all of those sorts of things? And then Lori, on the airport side, definitely throughout that presentation, there were hints that, you know, where consumers' mindset was going with international and wilderness travel, the ability or thinking about going to, you know, U.S. airports because they might have different regulations and rules than we do. But just the whole question about consumer confidence and human rights. So how are you tackling that, Brad, very specifically in the program that you're running? And then Lori, how does that kind of play into, you know, your planning as you move forward?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'll talk to it from both the rapid test kit side as well as the vaccination side as far as employers and employee rights are concerned. So obviously the rapid test kit program is voluntary. And if a business decides to participate, that's fine. And if they ask their employees to participate and an employee chooses not to, the employer certainly has options under employment and human rights areas that they would have to look at on a specific basis, depending on the nature of their business. So, of course, they can't force anyone to take a rapid test, but we're finding compliance to be very, very high. We're finding people are enthusiastic to participate. They want to be involved in it. And I think the same thing is, you know, on the vaccination side, and we've had many conversations with employment lawyers and human rights lawyers and others on, you know, can you insist on vaccinations? Well, generally speaking, the thinking is no. However, if you use the right level of moral suasion and the one good thing about rapid testing in the workplace is if you see your colleague doing it, you're probably more likely to participate in something like that. So we haven't had a lot of issues around that, as I understand it. But then again, these are voluntary programs. And there are businesses that are choosing not to participate for whatever reason. And there are ones that are choosing to participate. And they may have employees within their organization that say they're not going to participate. So they'll have to govern themselves accordingly and decide. But I think most people are happy to do it. They want a safe workplace. They want to make sure they are healthy and safe and their colleagues are healthy and safe. And that's generally the response that we've been getting back.
No, that's good to hear. So, Lori, when it comes to like the human rights issues, do you have to have proof of vaccination, all those types of things when people are moving across borders? That obviously filters, I'm sure, into every conversation you have, but I didn't really see any reporting on it in your slides.
Yeah, so 2 points. One is in terms of the testing that we're doing for our employees as well, that's all voluntary, just the way Brad's described it as well, so that no one's forced to do the testing. In terms of requirement to be vaccinated for travel, we've not taken the position that you have to be vaccinated to travel. It will, you know, your risk level as a non-vaccinated traveler versus your risk level as a fully vaccinated traveler is different. And as a result, the measures that you would have to undergo would be different. And so we treat it as a, just as we do, you know, how we operate generally in terms of aviation. It's a risk-based system, and you apply the various measures associated with the risk. So it's not the position from an airport perspective in Canada, from the GTA, even from that paper that we signed on to with the other global airports. It's not mandatory to be vaccinated to travel. You make a really great point about confidence, though, and sort of rebuilding people's confidence to travel. And so we do keep our eye on public sentiment related to travel and other doing other things in society. We have started to see that move slightly, and so probably about a 10-point jump at the end of May from the previous month around people's willingness to travel domestically. Willingness to travel internationally hasn't jumped quite as much, but we're still seeing it move in the right direction. And then they talk about things like going to a grocery store, going to a restaurant, attending a sporting event. So generally, the mood is shifting, and I think that's probably natural when you think about people feeling more confident about getting back to whatever this normal is going to be, as more people, the headlines in the morning paper aren't talking about cases going up, rather they're talking about cases going down, and the thing that's really important for building public trust is to have visibility in a transparent plan that people can see, so that you can see, you know, this is the next step we're going to make, but here's the next three or four steps before a full reopening to start to rebuild trust. And so that's proven to be helpful to rebuild trust in other countries we've seen, and something we've talked to our government about. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, great. I mean, we could talk all day, because then you start thinking about the difference between leisure and business, and then business policy on travel. And it gets into a very, again, yet another complicated, but that's great for now, just to kind of understand where your messaging is from a standpoint of the risk base. And, you know, the higher risk travel you are, the different requirements you're going to have. So it's good just to know that and hear that. Thank you.
Yeah. Stephen, you've come on camera, so do you have a question?
Yeah, just maybe, I'm sorry if I missed it, just a clarification. What's the financial model for funding this testing? Who purchased the test? Who pays for their analysis? What envelope of money did that come from? Is that all internal to MBOT, or is it from some other envelope?
Happy to answer that. As a matter of fact, Health Canada bought 40 million of these tests.
Yeah.
They were actually sitting in warehouses until somebody figured out that we should maybe use them. And somehow, I don't know exactly how it happened, but somehow the Provincial Ministry of Economic Development, the Ontario Chamber of Commerce got on board, found out what was going on, and said, well, this is ridiculous. Can we get these test kits into businesses to get them using them? It's, as I say, it's one of the tools in this whole pandemic. So the answer is the federal government paid for them. We are providing them through our distribution network at no charge to the business, zero. So they get them for free. And then the only administrative burden that they would have, the business would cost them anything, is they are asked to participate in a biohazardous waste program where they may have to bring in a company to specifically make sure the test kits, when they're used up, the swabs, etc., are put in a separate bin. There is a charge for that, $100 a month or something, for a company to come and pick that up. Most businesses have no issue with that. They say, if that's my cost of participating in this program, happy to do it. But other than that, there is no cost. This was 100% paid for by basically Health Canada, the federal government, and we just took advantage of the fact there was this massive inventory, and let's get it out the door and get it into businesses.
Okay. Can I follow up, Lori, with a follow-up question?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Brad. There was a big story in the news that the rapid response tests were sitting on shelves, and for some reason, with a reason really no one can explain to this day why they weren't used. Airport workers called for rapid testing at the beginning of the pandemic as the way to reduce workplace spread, and not just for airports, but of course for warehouses around the Peel area and everywhere else. And I'm glad that someone picked up the ball and at least tried to get some of these tests to workplaces. But my question is, maybe not for this pandemic, but for the next one, rapid testing is going to be a lot more prevalent. And does MBOT have the capacity to scale up this program? So we're not talking 30,000 tests distributed, but we're talking 3 million tests, right? We're talking about almost every worker in Peel, for example, getting tested twice a week at workplaces, so we can actually target shutdowns rather than mass shutdowns that we had. And I'm just wondering if you thought about that, and maybe the easier answer is that the Mississauga Board of Trade isn't the best organization to administer this testing, that it's something that's beyond your capacity. And I'm just wondering if you've reflected on that internally to think about where MBOT goes with this type of programming in the future.
I don't think we've looked at how this would happen in the future and whether or not we had another pandemic again. I think we responded to a call. We responded to an opportunity because the test kits were available. And the Chamber of Commerce Network is one of the best ways to get out to every business in every sector, because we represent businesses in every sector of the economy. It was the quickest way to get these tests out in communities. And as they say, this is all over Ontario. This is not just Mississauga Board of Trade. Yeah. I mean, Thunder Bay launched their program today. So, I mean, this is all over Ontario. And the goal was, what's the fastest way to get rapid test kits out to as many businesses that want to participate in a program as quickly as possible? And this was the way we did it this time. Look, we're gonna learn lessons from this. We're going to take lots of notes. We're going to put it in a new playbook for the next time. And hopefully the next time we are way better at all these things than maybe we've been this time. But right now, this is a really good program. I'm very proud of the Canadian Chamber, or Ontario Chamber of Commerce Network, for getting involved in this, and for the 60 plus chambers across Ontario that are administering it and running the program, and for the businesses that stepped up too and said, this is important. This is important for health and safety for me and my employees. And, you know, well, the next pandemic, let's hope we never have one, but we'll be better prepared, that's for sure.
Thank you.
There's no question there's going to be a lot of learnings coming out of this one. Hopefully we do document and learn from them and be more prepared next time. I'm pretty sure the airport will be. Thank you very much, Brad. Appreciate that. Any other questions before we move on to our roundtable? All right, so I think what I'll do, given it's a Zoom call and it's tougher, rather than going around the whole table for everyone, perhaps if anyone has any updates for the roundtable, put your hand up and we'll call you as we see your hands. Jonathan, go for it.
Hello, thanks. I do want to bring up one update. Some work that we've done recently. So the region, the city of Vaughan and the city of Markham, we collaborated, and Richmond Hill, we collaborated on a supply chain, with Supply Chain Canada, on a study called Building Supply Chain Resilience. And the purpose of the study was to assess the state of the manufacturing supply chain in the region, given the disruptions from the pandemic, and provide recommendations for both the companies and governments as we look to facilitate recovery and resilience. And the report was released a month ago, and it has within it 17 recommendations for businesses and all levels of government. So right now we're exploring what implementation of some of the recommendations could look like. So that's one of the things we're working on right now. And in addition to that, we have our economic development update report and our agriculture and agri-food strategy update report going to our committee of the whole on Thursday. So that's it for me.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan. We'd be really interested to see that study on supply chain. If you can share it, we'll circulate it to the committee. But one of the things that has been super clear during the pandemic is the need for goods to continue to move at a time when people weren't moving, and how you keep that happening, but also just the ability to produce locally as well is probably part of that. But if you could share that, that would be great.
Absolutely. I can share it.
From ACTA. Okay, thanks, yes. Jonathan. Heather, so nice to see you.
Yes, nice to see you and a few other familiar faces. I missed the last meeting, so yes, great to see you. I wanted to weigh in and let everyone know that thank you to GTAA, of course, our organization who represents travel agencies and travel agents and independent travel agents, as well as therefore indirectly our consumers as well. We received a copy of your recovery plan. So what you had indicated is within that plan is not out of step with other organizations, both national as well as kind of more global input too. So I just wanted to say that we support that, and just to also kind of dovetail off of what you were saying about what the situation is for the GTAA being down 88%, I think it was like 88.8%. Our situation in terms of our travel agencies, we remain after 15 months, we are still at a 95% revenue decline or greater. We still have about 90% are on furlough. We are an industry that is made up of about 50% being independent travel agents, and overall we have about 75% are women, and many of those independents are also on CRB. So overall, our industry remains in a dire and worsening situation. We've already seen a loss of over 800 storefront locations across the country. In an April survey, we are showing an additional loss of 75%. If we do not receive maximum support or sector-specific aid to the end of the year. And a lot of that is important to know that when business, of course, you know, Lori would understand that when businesses start to open, our sector will not recover at the same rate. As I'm so looking forward to when my hairdresser opens so I can finally get my hair cut. But I'll tell you, if I go in and into a travel agent, I can't do that. I can't go anywhere right now because borders are still closed. So we are not going to open at the same rate as other industries. And at the same time, how we are compensated. Typically, our industry does not get compensated until after travel occurs. So we are not going to see revenue until probably early 2022. Meanwhile, we're still having to continue to function and operate and incur mandatory expenses. And of course, now that the government has mandated refunds that are tied to the airline aid packages that were announced for a couple of our airlines, they need to be fulfilled, those obligations. And so we are continuing to work with no revenue. So I just wanted to kind of tell our story. And it is somewhat similar in terms of statistics, Lori.
Yeah, those are some pretty powerful and startling numbers that you share. So
yep.
Hang
pretty
in there.
Dire.
Pretty, pretty dire, yeah. So gosh, it's been a tough year for you, I'm sure. Thanks, and we'll make sure that as we're talking to government about restart, you're one of the sectors with us that's really hurting. I think the next hand, I don't know whether it was Stephen or Sabir, who wants to go next? How about you, Sabir?
Maybe, Laurie, I can go next.
Sure.
This is Sabir Syed from Region of Peel. And Heather, I'm permanently changing my haircutting schedule now. My son is doing a great job. Unfortunately, I did have an appointment schedule for him for 2 weeks, but now I think I'll get it by haircut tomorrow. So I think that's a good change, at least for now, until we are safe from the pandemic. So I've got two updates. First, as I mentioned to you last time, that the region of Peel has been designated as United Nations Regional Center of Expertise. What this means is that the entire region of Peel has been designated as the center of expertise. So city of Mississauga, city of Brampton, and town of Caledon included. And I'm very fortunate to say that there were only 4 RCEs added last year in 2020, and Peel was one of them. The other 3 were in Netherlands, USA, Malaysia. And one of our goals with for establishing this regional Peel Center of Expertise is it's a collaborative entity, and it will definitely aim at building a healthy and sustainable community for life. And we are focusing on the goods movement as well as the sustainable transportation. And I'm very pleased to let you know that the GTA did provide us the letter of support. So Laurie and Michael, thank you so much. We have other 10 partners who also provided the letter of support. So this includes 4 universities, University of Toronto, York, McMaster, and Ryerson University. And we also have Sheridan College. We also got a letter of support from TRCA as well as Pembina Institute, Retail Council of Canada, Loblaws, TAF, the Toronto Atmospheric Fund, Pembina, as well as the Muscat Transport Company. So we are very pleased that we have a very good support, and we will be working with you for establishing a sustainable community. My next update is regarding the public sector panel that I'm hosting on June 17th with Supply Chain Canada. And again, I'm very thankful to Michael Mendel. He's going to represent GTA at the public sector panel. And the other partners would be Transport Canada and MTO as well. And we'll be focusing on the sustainable goods movement. And there are many questions that we will be asking in relation to the sustainable goods movement. And we are going to connect with at least 400, 500 members and provide them the information that the good work that we are doing at the government level as well as the GTA level. This is my update, Laurie. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Sabir. Congratulations again on that United Nations designation. Stephen Tufts, please.
Yeah, very quickly. Just to let you know, the Toronto All Workers Council, we continue to work with workers, both employed, still employed in the sector, and of course, unemployed workers as well, who are waiting to come back to work. It's still very dire across the country. There are thousands of unemployed air aviation workers. There's starting to be a number of complications. People's assistance and employment assistance is starting to run out from different programs. Savings are starting to be spent, et cetera. A lot of workers, probably have left the sector and have taken, at minimum, especially at the lower end of the lower paying jobs, taking other jobs elsewhere. And this is a little bit concerning because there are some bright spots. Some of the information that's coming out, some of the panels and put together by the GTAA itself have indicated that there is evidence of significant pent-up demand, that the bounce back may be 2 years rather than 5 for the sector, which would be, of course, very good. We're also looking at what's happening in the United States with their recovery, which is going faster than even they anticipated, and that now they're, for a bunch of reasons that are very specific to the U.S. context, are facing labor shortages in the aviation sector, with Delta Airlines having to cancel flights because they can't find enough workers. And we don't want to be in that position if there happens to be, if we're lucky enough, to get a more rapid recovery in this sector in Canada. And one of the things we fought for and advocated for from the very beginning with the GTA's assistance was to put in a platform for workers to maintain their relationship with the airport and sector. And we're hoping that that will pay off dividends, especially if it comes to a situation where there isn't a demand for labor and that there's a means of contacting workers to let them know that the airport is going to start hiring again. So I think that we're still in a very unpredictable situation. I think it was mentioned earlier, no one has a perfect crystal ball. There's a lot of contradictory evidence and trends that we're seeing. But I think even with the passenger levels down where they are today, which is still significantly low, we're hopeful that the recovery won't be at the worst case scenario, which was dating us to 2025, 2026 to get to 2019 levels. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. Really important points to bring up. Any other members of committee have any updates for us or items they'd like to report on? Okay, seeing none, I did want to make sure we... Oh, sorry. Aileen?
Hi, Laurie. Hi, did you see my hand? Hi. Oh, great. Just a quick update from the Toronto Board of Trade side. So further to the presentation earlier in the meeting, I will be sharing a link in the chat function with all of you for where you can go to find those 5 reports once they're available. I'll also share a link to a report that came out in April. So it did come out between our last meeting and this one from the Board of Trade. It's the Fast Forward report, which includes recommended medium-term economic recovery actions for government and businesses to take within the next 1 to 3 years. And then the final update is that the Toronto Board of Trade AGM will be taking place on June 16th. So for any of those of you who might be planning to join, registration will be open until this Friday. That's it for me.
Terrific. Thanks so much. Okay, last call for committee members or any of our technical members. I don't see any other hands. Mr. Batty, I wanted to make sure we had a chance to hear any questions that you may have in any of our presentations or any updates or comments you wanted to make to the group.
Yeah, Laurie, thank you very much. As always, you run a very good meeting, and I thank you for that. I have a very quick question. At your annual general meeting, Ms. Flynn in the literature suggested that because of COVID, she was going to probably update her 20-year plan. The reason I ask that question is Oshawa Airport, which you'll probably surprise you, Oshawa Airport is trying to update their plan, and they're having a great deal of difficulty with it because Oshawa would like to close, and they can't go ahead without Pickering being announced, and Pickering can't go ahead without a capacity issue at Toronto International, and KPMG have said that 2036 is their capacity issue, which, as you know, is very clearly at odds with your progressions of capacity. So I'm rather keen on hearing what Ms. Flint is actually intending to do about her 20-year plan.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we're all, as airports, thinking about what recovery will look like. And as Stephen was just mentioning, there's been some thought that recovery was going to be a number of years and very slow. We're starting to watch and see other countries recover and watching carefully. We really don't know at this point. I think we're sharpening our pencils and thinking about it and watching how recovery is going to start to come back. At this point, there is no new plan to share, but those plans, as you know, are always ultimately become public documents. So we'll make sure that this committee and you and anyone who wants it gets access through our website. But it really is a challenge for aviation right now, understanding exactly how recovery will happen, what sectors will come back, what type of travel will resume. I think everyone's loosely thought it would be sort of domestic before international, leisure before business, but that's still a bit of crystal ball in that we just don't know yet. I know my colleague Eileen Wader is still on the call, and Eileen's got much deeper roots into our planning group from her years there. Eileen, is there anything you would add to that?
No, I think you've outlined it quite well, Lori. Ultimately, we're in a place where we don't know what we don't know. The future is murky. Julian has done a great job trying to anticipate how the traffic might come back and the rate and the way in which it might manifest itself. We've heard today on the call about questions around consumer confidence. The group and the organization as a whole is eagerly trying to figure out what the path is to recovery, how long recovery will take, and what segments of the traffic will come first and second, et cetera. I think it's still a little too murky for us to be more definitive beyond saying the impact of the pandemic will definitely have an impact on the long-term planning. We're just waiting to see if there's a few more clear indicators before diving deeper into a review of the specific details of the plan. So as Lori said, that updates will be made along the way, but 2020 and the large part of 2021 thus far has still found us in a state of response and preparing to recover, while still, as you've heard earlier too, having questions of government about how the restart will happen. So
I apologize, Mr. Batty, if we're not giving you a very clear answer, but I think that's just indicative of where we find ourselves right now.
Thank you. I know, I understand. I thank you very much. This online capability, I hope you continue to do it into the future. It's very, very enlightening.
Well, thanks for joining us today. All right, Ingrid, that takes us to the end of our meeting today. I'm just looking. Our next meeting is scheduled for September the 14th. That's correct. Hopefully it's still warm and we've all had a lovely summer and hopefully everyone gets a chance to get some time away from work. And I really do hope that from an aviation perspective and just well a recovery perspective, we all have different news to report and some more positive stats to share with each other. So I wish you all a wonderful summer. And we'll see you in the fall. If there's anything between now and then, you all know how to get in touch with us. And I hope you'll not hesitate to pick up the phone.
Thanks, Lori. Great update.
Thanks, Lori. Have a good one.
I guess we technically need a motion to adjourn. Jonathan, I saw your hand wave, so you're going to move that motion.
Yes.
And I see Stephen seconding it. So all those in favor, that's a good one. I don't think I need to ask that question. Take care, everyone.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.